case number 10-1080, United States Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection Petitioner versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. Mr. Scher for petitioner, Ms. Capel for respondent, Mr. Atkins for intervener.
Oh, we do. You did hear this. If you're afraid to let your car, you understand.
Okay.
You remember our case?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Howard Scher, and I represent the agency, the Customs and Border Protection, in this case. I'd like to reserve, if I can, 2 minutes for rebuttal. As the Court is aware, this is the third time this particular contract provision, the revised National Inspection Assignment Policy, has been before the Court. In the first case, in 414F3rd, this Court stated that and I'll use RNIAP as the language for that long contract. The RNIAP was lawfully implemented. The RNIAP was a condition of employment. The authority said it was in its first decision, which this Court quoted in the 413F3rd decision, that sought to change the way management would make assignments. It also established that permissive subjects would no longer be bargained, and any permissive subject that had been part of a prior contract would no longer be in effect, and that's because the original National Labor Agreement had already expired. So there was authority to do that. But the RNIAP did more than that. It, in addition, proposed a way in which management would make inspectional assignments in the future and invited bargaining at the national level with the agency, with the union on that. The union engaged in inadequate or ineffective procedures, and as a result, the RNIAP was legally lawfully implemented, as this Court held. That lawful implementation essentially allowed us to implement the RNIAP with respect to all the provisions that are in it. And the provisions in it direct local managers to use a certain sort of matrix of factors to make inspectional assignments in the future. The union lost its opportunity to bargain at the national level over the revised NIAP when it failed to negotiate in the period between August 1 of 2001 and September 30 of 2001. That's the core principle and the core notion that we've been trying to project to the Court in both in the first case, RNIAP 1, and then in the second case, which was the 453rd F3rd case. And we intervened in that, in the 453rd F3rd case, to make the point that what the lawful implementation of the revised NIAP meant was that we had satisfied our obligation to negotiate or bargain at the national level, and therefore all the provisions within the context, within the framework of the RNIAP, were therefore the conditions of employment to be applied to local assignment changes.
Doesn't that principle come from case laws where there's actually inaction by the union? The union does nothing. That's not what we have here, right?
Well, we do in a sense.
The union came into action.
I think there's a whole range of ways in which this principle operates, but the real point is you have agreed with the authority on this, that we lawfully implemented this based on the union's failure either to negotiate appropriately because they attached a condition that was improper, or you could put it another way, that's inaction. They did not propose a counterproposal to the revised NIAP.
Couldn't the authority wasn't it perfectly reasonable for the authority to conclude that while they may have given up their right to negotiate locally, they didn't give up their right to negotiate nationally?
And that's a mistake there, is that the authority doesn't appreciate that when it held originally that we lawfully implemented the revised NIAP, we had implemented a document
for the agency, for the union to give up its right to negotiate, I assume the authority's view is it has to give it up, has to be clear. And it seems to me it probably thought here just wasn't clear.
Well, it seems to me there are two things about that. One is the authority, I think, doesn't quite come to terms with, and we've pressed this point several times, with the fact that we did subject the revised NIAP, a condition of employment, with terms about how management would implement its assignments in the future at local ports, to national-level bargaining. And the union failed to respond in the appropriate way. They tied a condition that was invalid to the bargaining, and then the authority in the RNIAP 1 case, and then this court, sustained the fact that the revised NIAP was, in fact, lawfully implemented. So what did that mean? It meant that the revised NIAP as a policy, also defined as a condition of employment in the statute, a policy applying to local assignments at ports, was lawfully implemented. The union takes, and the arbitrator.
It was lawfully implemented.
Yeah.
But that doesn't answer the question, does it?
It does, because what we sought to bargain about were the conditions under which the management would make assignments at local ports or local ports of entry. That's what the revised NIAP, like the NIAP itself, proposed to do. It set out certain terms in this regard. If you would compare, for example, the Section 5 of the NIAP at 123 to 128 or 138 of the joint appendix.
Your position is they didn't change any conditions. They haven't changed any conditions of employment. Is that
the,
your point?
Our point is the revised NIAP was a lawfully implemented condition of employment which set forth the terms by which local assignments would be made, that the union failed to negotiate. So, for example, had they submitted terms to us as to how we would make these local assignments, we would have negotiated over those, or we could have gone to impasse over them.
Your
Judge Rogers?
Is you didn't like their response because they tied it. I mean, they responded.
And that's the very point of, they did respond, and they responded with a condition that was unlawful. I think it's almost, when you ask that question, it's like second-guessing the fact that this court has already held that it's a lawfully implemented condition of employment, the revised NIAP. As to the terms in it, which assign,
as to whether or not it went to these mandatory. And you're relying heavily, are you, on this statement that the authority made about conditions of employment originally?
Well, it's an important aspect of it, but what we're also relying on is the notion of the covered by doctrine here. They're integrally related, whether this is a policy or whether it's a contract. We could debate it. The covered by doctrine.
Wouldn't we defer to the agency on that?
Well, normally you would, except for the fact that the agency's or the authority's view about...
Got it wrong.
Well, they got it wrong based on...
Argument, isn't it?
Well, based on an inadequate, as this court said, and Judge Tatel sat on that court in the 399 F3rd NFFE case, the agency has a duty to adequately, reasonably, and coherently explain its position in reference back to inadequate explanations are insufficient. And the authority here has never taken the language of the statute and parsed it the way we did in our brief and the way Chairman Kavanaugh did several times. And that's our point there, that with respect to whether this is an agreement, and it is in our view, the authority has simply said several things. One, there was no mutual assent. Well, we know mutual assent.
So you want us to remand it for some clarification on that?
Well, the court could do that, but I think the related issue of condition of employment is also self-sustaining, and the court, I think, should, if the court has any doubt about whether the covered by doctrine applies, just simply go to our second argument, which is that this is a condition of employment. The revised NIAP is a condition of employment. The authority said so in its decision that led to this court's affirmance in 414 F3rd, and it's a condition of employment that lays out.
But why, take for example the customs agents who have been transferred from one airport to another, right? Isn't that a change in their conditions of employment?
Change from one local...
Yeah, isn't that what this was all about? There's a grievance that talks about people being transferred from Houston to some other airport in Texas, right? Isn't that a change in their conditions of employment?
That's a change in their working conditions, and here we get into the...
Why isn't a change in their conditions of employment?
Because the condition of employment is defined in the statute. It's a policy practice that affects working conditions. Yeah. And the policy here is the revised NIAP.
Moving from one airport to another doesn't affect your working condition. How about the new work schedule?
Well, it does.
New work schedule in Seattle. That's not a change in terms of conditions of employment?
It's change in working conditions because, and this is the important part of our argument, the revised NIAP is a policy, and the statute 7103A14 defines a condition of employment as a policy or a practice and other things that affect working conditions. The revised NIAP is the condition of employment because it is the policy.
Well, that's what you assert, but couldn't the condition of employment also be what happens on the ground? I mean,
well,
the condition of employment is, the original condition of employment was they worked at one airport. Now there's a different practice, they work at a different airport, and that condition of employment affects their working conditions.
And I would answer that.
It's a really ambiguous statute. The agency is interpreted this way. What possible basis do we have to question that?
And so the disagreement I would have with that, with Your Honor, is that that was the whole point of the revised NIAP, was to establish a policy that would affect working conditions. We invited the negotiation over it. The union could have come back with any set of array of terms under which they could have suggested or proposed that management exercise its management's right to assign at the local ports in any number of ways. They could have affected whether seniority applied to overtime, the call-out orders, et cetera, the work week and shift changes and schedules, et cetera. They could have made such proposals. Those would have been the guiding principle, the guiding policy under which local assignment changes would have been made. The same as they've done, and I should mention this to the court, the same as they would have done in renegotiating, say, a national labor agreement, in which they, along with the agency, would have agreed to a whole set of terms under which, at the national level, the union and the agency agreed to terms about how local assignments would be made. And I should mention that if things go well, there will be such an agreement on May 11th signed by the parties. It doesn't moot this case because there's a damages claim involving perhaps lost overtime based on the decisions that were made by the agency pursuant to its revised NIAP. But the fact of the matter is, when and this is the critical point, when the agency sent to the union the revised NIAP requesting bargaining at the national level, it was essentially doing what the parties do when they come to agreement on a national labor agreement at the national level, except that it was a side agreement. The union just simply failed to propose any counter provisions. This, for example, then...
I guess I don't understand. I mean, the union said we want to do two things, not just one thing. And you say because they came up with this time proposal, they have waived any right. And the agency disagrees with you.
Well, no, the agency, the authority takes the position.
Well, they bought into the arbitrator's decision an interim award.
Right. So the difference that we're having, I think, over this case is this. The authority agrees, and I urge the court to look at their statements at page 21 and 26 of the brief. We cite their brief. They agree that the revised NIAP was lawfully implemented, as this court has held. Their difference with us is that they are contending that we still have an obligation to bargain at the national level over changes. Our position is we already went through that. When we submitted the revised NIAP to the union and the union failed to negotiate appropriately, it lost its ability to negotiate at the national level anymore.
We understand.
And I think that really is the difference of opinion about this. The authority just can't seem to, okay. Hasn't come to terms with that argument.
Right.
I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Well, counsel for the authority.
Thank you. Your Honors, let me begin by addressing something my opposing counsel stated. You had asked him whether the ARNIAP terminates bargaining at the national level, and his response was basically that the ARNIAP was a lawfully implemented document. But that is not a complete answer. In our view, the ARNIAP does not terminate bargaining at the national level. First of all, when looking at the context of the ARNIAP, it was implemented in response to a 2001 executive order.
But I thought his argument was that they offered to bargain the ARNIAP with you at a national level, and you just didn't.
And that therefore, but the union, by not bargaining, waived its right to bargain at the national level. The ARNIAP is not an agreement, and unless you can, a union cannot waive a right unless there has been an agreement, unless there's been clear and unmistakable waiver. And here, nothing that the union did indicated any agreement with the ARNIAP. They were active every step of the way, as you describe. When it looked as though the parties reached impasse, they went to the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service and the Federal Service Impasse Panel to try to resolve the difference over their proposed ground rule. When the ARNIAP was issued, 4 days after it was issued, NTEU requested bargaining. And when the ARNIAP was finally implemented, NTEU filed a grievance. And then when it won its grievance before the arbitrator, it opposed the agency's exceptions, and so at no point can it be said that the union agreed to the ARNIAP. Another point that opposing counsel makes is that the agency failed to explain give an adequate explanation as to why the ARNIAP is not an agreement, but it did explain that. It explained it in its decision in NTEU Chapter 137 at 60 FLRA 483, and the authority explained that the reason that the ARNIAP is not a collective bargaining agreement is that it was not part of any agreement between the parties. And you cannot have a collective bargaining agreement without having agreement, a mutual assent. Another point my opposing counsel makes is that the ARNIAP itself is a condition of employment. And that is true. The ARNIAP does have changes to conditions of employment.
Let me back up for a second. Is that right that there has to be an express agreement to have a collective?
Not an express agreement. It can be an express agreement or an agreement through conduct.
Right.
And here we had neither, which distinguishes it from the Department of Labor case. Here there was the union did everything it could to oppose. At no point was there anything it did could be construed as agreement.
My memory is the authority just cited the previous NTEU case. It was a very terse description. It didn't go into any sort of analysis of why there wasn't an agreement. It just made a conclusory statement that there was an agreement. The briefing, however, was quite helpful.
Oh, you're talking about the Chapter 137 case.
Yeah,
it did say that there was not an agreement because it was not part of any agreement between the parties. And in footnote 12 of that case, it contrasted it with the Department of Labor case involving the Memorandum of Understanding, where there, by its actions, the union, by not seeking resolution of an impasse, had implicitly agreed. And it contrasted that situation with our situation here. So I believe that we did adequately explain why the ARNIAP is not an agreement. It is true, as opposing counsel says, that the ARNIAP is a change to conditions of employment. It did change some things. It terminated the right to bargain permissively. It delegated authority to the local managers to change work assignment policies. However, what's relevant here is that the ARNIAP contains no conditions of employment that are relevant to the union's grievances, which concern length of work week, tour of duty, overtime. There are no policies or procedures in the ARNIAP that provide any guidance as to how to make decisions on these scheduling issues. All the ARNIAP has is a statement that that policy on work assignment is to be determined by local managers and that they have authority to change it as required by operational needs or budgetary limitations. Operational needs and budgetary limitations are not policies and procedures on resolving work scheduling issues. And when you look at what the management did, its new policies on work assignment, those were changes to conditions of employment. As you pointed out, they affected employees' working conditions, affecting their schedules. And because these new policies were changes to conditions of employment, the agency had a duty to bargain over them, to offer impact and implementation over these policies. And by not doing so, the agency committed an unfair labor practice. However, despite this, the agency argues that nonetheless it had no duty to bargain, that the covered by doctrine excused it from bargaining. But because the RNIAF is not a collective bargaining agreement, the covered by doctrine simply doesn't apply. The agency next argues that even if the covered by doctrine doesn't apply, the changes are not bargainable because they're changes to working conditions instead of conditions of employment. However, it seems clear that these new policies are changes to conditions of employment. They do change the work life of the customs inspectors. Unless you have further questions, the authority asks that you uphold its decision and deny the petition for review.
Thank you. All right, counsel for intervener.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
When the court, as it must, accords considerable deference to the FLRA's special expertise in applying the statute to the complexities of the federal sector labor relations regime, it must conclude that its decision in this case was a reasonable one, and for that reason, the agency's petition must be denied. Ms. Capel has already explained that the authority has repeatedly held that the implementation of the RNIAP document did not extinguish NTEU's rights to bargain at the national level, which is the level of exclusive recognition, over changes to conditions of employment that take place at the local level. The authority's decision in that area was, again, most reasonable one. And I think you can certainly see that the authority took into context the situation that precipitated the issuance of the NIAP. And there are several sources that can inform and direct the court to determine that the authority's actions in this regard were reasonable. As Ms. Capel mentioned, Chapter 137 case at 60 FLRA 483, which is quoted and relied on heavily in the case before the court today, explained the situation. There are accounts of NIAP's genesis in this court's two prior decisions at 414 F3rd at pages 53 through 54. And at 453 F3rd at page 509. And finally, the party's own stipulations in this case before the arbitrator at joint appendix pages 42 through 43, paragraphs 12 and 15, really tell the story. And from that, a clear picture emerges from these sources. Following the issuance of the executive order 13203 in 2001, the agency decided to terminate and no longer be bound by provisions in the National Labor Agreement, RNIAP, and any locally negotiated assignment policies that pertain to provisions involving Section 7106B1 matters. Now, that's a section of the United States Code which allows the agency, but not require it, to negotiate over things such as the numbers, types, and grades of people assigned to do work, methods, means, and technologies. These are commonly known as permissive bargaining topics. And after the issuance of the executive order, the agency clearly indicated that it didn't want to do that anymore. It wasn't bound to do that. The previous executive order told agencies to bargain over these things. The executive order issued in 2001 said, you no longer have to bargain over these things. And the agency's intention in this regard was made clear in the issuance of NIAP itself. In the Chapter 137 case at 60 FLRA 483, there's a specific description of the cover letter that accompanied the issuance of the RNIAP document. The letter said that the agency would no longer be bound by the provisions in NIAP and LIAPs, the local assignment policies, which contain provisions that involve Section 7106B1 matters. including several that require local bargaining on such things as minimum staffing levels and tours of duty. That's what it was about. And the authority made its decision in the context of this background, using its special expertise to evaluate both the statute and the record, and determined under these circumstances, the issuance of RNIAP did not extinguish the union's right to bargain at the national level over conditions of employment. And as the court has recognized today, the types of things at issue here, assignment policies, where people work, when they work, how many officers are assigned, these plainly fall within the definition of conditions of employment in the statute. And nothing in RNIAP prescribed how those decisions were to be made. RNIAP only said those decisions were to be made in the future by local managers. And RNIAP rescinded the previously existing agreement that the agency made with the union to bargain over the substance of those matters. So we were left with what the statute provides for us. We still had the opportunity to bargain over the impact and implementation of those changes pursuant to Section 7601, B2 and B3.
What is your response to the factual allegation that you didn't agree, that you were given an opportunity to bargain at this at the national level and you simply didn't?
We took advantage of the opportunity, Your Honor. As soon as the RNIAP was proposed to the union acted promptly. We proposed that the RNIAP be combined in bargaining with the National Labor Agreement because many things in the two documents are related. We also immediately sought the assistance of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service when an impasse was reached. And after that, we sought assistance of the Federal Service Impasses Panel when an impasse was reached. We engaged in the bargaining process that the statute provides for. This stands in stark contrast to the situation in the Department of Labor case, where the union there did not respond to a letter that was sent to it by the agency, and when impasse was reached, did not avail itself of the services of the Federal Service Impasses Panel. The union did what it was supposed to have done. And in addition to that, once things turned out that the RNIAP was going to be implemented over our objections, the union filed grievances, we arbitrated cases.
The authority's explanation for why its discussion of covered by doctrine and its explanation for why it was of the view that there was a collective there was not a collective bargaining agreement here is terse at best, right?
Well, but the authority reasonably rejected the agency.
Why you think it's sufficient?
Well, the authority reasonably rejected the agency's assertion that RNIAP was a collective bargaining agreement for purposes of the application of the covered by doctrine, and the authority explained itself. In its past decisions, the authority emphasized that parties must mutually establish rules. That's what the covered by doctrine is all about. It's an opportunity for parties to engage in negotiations and to set.
Where did it provide this explanation that you're referring to now?
That's in the
cited a case, right?
It's in the SSA case, 47 FLRA. I don't have the site in front of me, but it's discussed in the party's briefs. And the notion that a collective bargaining agreement is an essential element of the covered by doctrine is present in that case, of the authority's case, and it's also consistent with this court's approach in the marine logistics case, where the court explained that the parties are free to contract. They are free to set a course of conduct.
I understand the doctrine. I'm just quarreling with the adequacy of the authority's explanation here.
Well, the authority reasonably concluded that in order to have to be covered by the covered by doctrine, which applies only to agreements, you must first have an agreement, and agreement's lacking here. And I think the authority's determination in that regard, applying its special expertise to the statute and the intricacies of the federal sector labor relations system, was adequate. In its decision where it explains the covered by doctrine, it emphasizes that the parties need an agreement. This court in marine logistics emphasized that an essential part of the covered by doctrine is an agreement. We think the authority's explanation was sufficient, Your Honor. And I don't think there's any need to remand because of the authority's explanation and the fact that the authority's view is really consistent with the view that this court has taken in marine logistics.
And I thought the authority said they had repeatedly held that the RNIAP is not a collective bargaining agreement.
They had. In previous cases, the cases in which the authority issued that
provided no basis for the agency to reverse its precedent.
Right. The authority had repeatedly held in the Chapter 137 case and in subsequent cases, based on its covered by doctrine, that this particular document is not an agreement. And if it's not an agreement, it does not fall under the covered by doctrine. And we think the authority was reasonable in making that determination.
Thank you. Counsel for petitioner?
Let me take that last point first. The authority's first decision, which they said you needed agreement or assent, mutual assent, was a one-line statement. And as this court, and then they've been referring ever since back to that one-line statement. So it's been terse all along. And as this court said in the 399 F3rd case involving the NFFE union, it's inadequate. You can't use an inadequate explanation and sort of jump and keep piling on the inadequacy by just referring back.
If it's apples and oranges, do you have to keep describing it in great detail that an orange is different than an apple?
Well, I think what you have to do is tell us why you have cases in which there are inaction and other forms of non-union participation which agreements result from, and why that doesn't apply to this situation. And Judge,
you cite the idea that an impasse panel could impose certain conditions and you'd still end up with a collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct.
But the union went to impasse, didn't it? It sought impasse. So we don't have that situation where there is a subsequent agreement.
Well, it didn't occur here for two reasons. One, they didn't submit a counterproposal to us, which then would have led to perhaps to some bargaining over the terms and would have made perhaps more specific the revised assignment policy. They didn't counter, so we had no opportunity to address those terms and or move ourselves or declare an impasse, in which case there would have been a lawful impasse and the impasses panel might have imposed one or the other sets of proposals or a completely different proposal. The complaint here that, and I see my time is up, but may I make a mention of this? The complaint here that the revised assignment policy is not specific enough is not our fault. We said this is how we are going to make the assignments in the future. The union could have countered with virtually, I think, every term in the revised NIAP that previously existed, except the ones that called for local bargaining, and we would have had some engagement over proposals. But we were prevented from that because the union inappropriately and inadequately proposed a tie-in on how bargaining should be completed, and they were wrong about that. And they failed to use the mechanism that they had in order to make the condition of employment, namely the revised agreement, revised assignment policy, more specific. Let me just say,
can I ask you one question? How do you understand the arbitrator's statement that there's no inference to be drawn as to whose fault it was that no bargaining occurred on the national level?
Well, I don't know how to respond to that as to fault. I don't think we assign fault here. I think what we say is there's a process, a collective bargaining process. We came out with an exercise of a management right, which this court recognized in the 414 F3rd case, and it was up to the union to come back with impact and implementation bargaining. That was their obligation, and they didn't. And therefore, we lawfully implemented a condition of employment. And this is what the authority said in its customs case that became the RNIAP 1 case. This is 59 FLRA at 708. They said, the RNIAP proposed a specific change in unit employees' conditions of employment pursuant to the exercise of management's rights. This court quoted it at 414 F3rd at 55. So we had no obligation to be specific necessarily. We proposed, and I think nothing in the statute, nothing in any of the case law I ever saw from the authority requires us to be any more specific than we are going to exercise our management right to assign by delegating to local managers with the following matrix of factors. We did that. It was incumbent upon the union at that point to do the impact and implementation bargaining, and they didn't.
Thank you.
And that's our position.
All right, thank you. We will take the case under advisement.
Stand, please. This honorable court will now take a brief recess to the next case, which will be heard in a closed courtroom.